Hello, and welcome to the Healing No Filter podcast. I'm your host, Laura Renner. I'm an author, a nurse, and frankly, someone who's been through a whole lot. I'm here to provide you with a weekly dose of relatable, no-nonsense methods for healing your mind, body, and all things trauma-related. Now let's dive in. Hello, hello. Today, I'm really honored to share this really powerful episode that I recorded with Amanda Blackwood. She has such an empowering story of overcoming sex trafficking and many other really traumatic experiences. She is so strong and such a light, and she provides so many nuggets of wisdom and important messages here that we can really all benefit from. Despite going through extremely painful experiences, which would beat many people down and make it easy to fall into a negative mindset, yet Amanda has such a positive outlook on life. I really learned a lot from hearing her story in this episode, even though I've actually heard her speak many times before. But hearing it again just gave me so much proof and inspiration of how you can really get through anything, of how strong you can be, and how you can take your power back and make your life whatever you want it to be, which is something we all could use a refresher of. Amanda brings such a great perspective to life that is incredibly refreshing and authentic, and I'm really excited and truly honored to share this episode with you. I do want to give a disclaimer that this may be triggering. She is very open and vulnerable about the details of her experiences, but I will say the outcome and the message here is pure gold. I especially love her view of forgiveness and how we often blame ourselves for things that aren't our fault, which she will, of course, get into. So, without further ado, here is my conversation with the incredible Amanda Blackwood. Today, I get the pleasure of speaking with Amanda Blackwood. Amanda is a survivor of human trafficking who is now an accomplished artist, an author, public speaker, podcast host, and trauma recovery mentor. Despite the numerous challenges she faced, she was able to emerge stronger with the help of her faith. Amanda has shared her story on various platforms, such as international summits and radio programs, and has published over a dozen books. Her two main podcasts seek to provide insights into healing from trauma. Always looking for a way to help, a portion of every book Amanda sells will go to help fight human trafficking. Amanda lives in Denver, Colorado, with her rescue cats and supportive husband who keep her sane. Welcome, Amanda. I am so excited to chat with you today. This is going to be such a great episode.
Thank you so much, Laura. You live right down the street from me. I feel like I already know you so well and we've never met.
I know. I love how, you know, the internet connects us, yet we still are actually geographically close. But this is so great because we probably, you know, would have just seen each other out in public and would have just crossed paths and never would have even known.
Yep, absolutely. And that's why we actually get to have a conversation.
Yes. And I'm super excited about this one. So for everybody listening, Amanda has a really compelling story. So Amanda, I'd love for you to just dive into your story.
So one of the things that I usually touch on right away is that human trafficking, most victims of trafficking have experienced some kind of childhood trauma and abuse in their lives. So it can be a little bit triggering for other people that have gone through similar situations. So I don't go into a lot of detail on it. But the first time I ever remember being molested, I was only 4. It was my older brother. My mother was mentally and emotionally abusive. My father was physically abusive. And this was my entire family. My dad was in the military, so we moved around all the time, constantly moving from one place to another. I did not have extended family that we were close to. I grew up seeing and believing that people only go back to visit their families once every 5 years or so. It's been a lot longer than that for me. But there wasn't this strong connection. You know, repeated assaults and different things continued to happen throughout my life when I was growing up. So I was molested again at 12 by a kid in a swimming pool. Again, at 13, by an uncle by marriage, at 15, by a total stranger in broad daylight in a very busy public parking lot. By the time I was 16, I knew that nobody was ever going to actually be there for me to help me. I was on my own. And at 17, the person that I thought was my best friend raped me. So by the time I was 18 years old, I had been running away for 3 years already. I started at 15. I really didn't have any direction in my life. I was a high school dropout. Best job I could find was as a cashier in a gas station. One of the things that was lacking in my life was stability, and had always been lacking. I also didn't have anybody that I felt really loved me or cared about me. And there was somebody that I met who met all of the needs that I had. They gave me a roof over my head, and they told me they loved me. They hugged me when I would cry. This man was more than twice my age, but that didn't bother me at the time. Obviously, I had daddy issues. I ended up in this relationship with this man, moved in with him, and I suppose he took really good care of me until he didn't. And what I mean by that is one day his best friend came over to visit for a couple of minutes, and his best friend said, "Hey, I've got a birthday coming up. I'm going to Las Vegas for my birthday. Do you guys want to go with me?" And my boyfriend at the time told him, "Well, I can't. I've got to work. But she's free. Why don't you take her with you?" And it was proposed to me, "Hey, Amanda, how would you feel about an all expenses paid trip to Las Vegas? You can go and have a good time, and you'd be there for a couple of days, and then you just come back home. Does that sound like fun?" I'd been through Vegas. I had ridden the roller coaster at the top of New York, and I was excited to go back. And I absolutely agreed. I mean, this was my boyfriend that was sending me. This guy loved me. He wanted to take care of me. He wanted me to go and have a good time. And I was so excited that he would give me this opportunity, even though he wasn't able to go. The whole thing was staged, that whole conversation. We got to Vegas, and this guy paid off the front desk to not ask questions. I was taken up to the hotel room, not given a key, and told if I were to leave this room, I would not be able to get back in, and I wouldn't be able to get back to where I was living to get any of my stuff. Or I was just stuck. And for a period of 52 hours, I was allowed to get room service once a day. And the front desk people were told that they had to drop it off at the door and leave before I could collect it. They weren't to ask any questions. They didn't need to know who I was. I was over 18. This guy had my ID so he could show them that I was over 18 so that they didn't need to ask any questions. Because when you're over 18, it's all legal. I think that was the dirtiest part of it all. So for this period of time, he would come up and assault me or molest me or rape me, eat whatever it was that I had ordered, a couple bites of it, whatever, and either take a nap or go back downstairs and gamble. And this repeated on a cycle, like I was stuck in a washing machine, over and over and over again, over a period of a little over 2 days, 52 hours. By the end of this, I had already done so many things to myself, like told myself, "I've been through worse. I get through this too." I told myself, "I'm stronger than this. He's never going to break me. Nobody is going to help me. Nobody's ever there for me." Every time I ran away when I was a teenager, the cops ended up driving me back home. And I told myself, if I leave now and I go tell the police, they're just going to drag me back and give me back to him because he's got my ID. I didn't see myself as anything except something that was owned. He had my ID, so he owned me. I was his possession, and the cops absolutely were going to take me back to this guy. He had my ID. Possession's 9/10 of the law, right? It was a possession. So we got down in Vegas, got back to Arizona, and I packed my stuff and I left as quick as I could. And I slept on people's couches, and I traveled from one place to another. Eventually, I made my way down to Florida. My plan there was to go and stay with my grandmother, my dad's mom, and get to know her while I recovered from having a knee surgery done. When I got there, it was about 10:30 at night, and I called my grandmother's house to have them come and get me, and her husband, my dad's stepfather, answered the phone and said, "We're not coming to get you. You're on your own. Good luck." And left me there in a strange city, in a bus station with $5 to my name. And they acted like they didn't care. It really hurt. I didn't understand what had happened. It took many, many years for me to find out that the reason this happened was because my parents had called them and said, she's running away from her problems again. And if you take her in, we'll never speak to you again. And a young couple found me sitting on the side of this little hill right next to the payphone. I was crying my eyes out, hugging my knees, just sobbing. I have no idea how they understood me, but somehow I was able to tell them what all had happened. And he was in his early to mid 20s. And she looked like she was 18. It turned out she was 15. And this couple took me in. And they said that they had a place for me to stay until I could get on my feet. In reality, what they meant was they had a place where I could stay until they found the highest bidder. And they sold me to a guy named Esteban for $90. That's all my life was worth. $90. I was locked up in a small room for 23 and a half hours with no food, no water, no bathroom facilities of any kind. But I grew up watching MacGyver in the 80s. And I love Richard Dean Anderson. For a while, I was convinced I was going to grow up to marry the guy, but I married the perfect man for me. And I've written to him and I've told him that watching his show is what saved my life in this instance. And I've never gotten any kind of response from him, but I have to trust that he knows, especially as often as I get to say it on interviews and stuff. He's heard. He knows. He's probably heard it a million times where people are like, hey, have you heard about this girl over here? So he knows. But if you're listening, Richard Dean Anderson, I love you. And I got out of that room and I went on the run. First person that I saw was a female police officer who thought I had completely lost my mind, that I was on drugs. She didn't believe a word that was coming out of my mouth. She ended up seeing this guy that was chasing after me do an illegal U-turn. She went after him for that. And I never went back to that place where I was being held. When I was held there, I knew there were other people there. I could hear them crying out and asking for help, just as like I was. And I didn't go back for them. And because of that, I had this incredible amount of survivor's guilt. I could have done something to help them. Years later, I learned that the average lifespan of somebody in this world of human trafficking is approximately 7 years. At the end of 7 years, they're usually dead. And I also learned that less than 2% survive. Looking back now, that survivor's guilt that I was feeling, I didn't know these numbers. I didn't have any clue, any awareness of what all of this stuff meant. I mean, this was 1999. People weren't even really talking about human trafficking back then. This wasn't a buzzword. This wasn't a thing. This was, as my mother put it, a mistake I made. I trusted the wrong people. I put myself in these terrible positions. It will never be the case. People who have been abused, it is never their fault. No matter what you've done, no matter what kind of position you've put yourself in, abuse is never the fault of the abused. I had left Florida and I moved to California because that was as far away as I could get from Florida without having a passport or winter clothing. And I loved my life in California for a while. And so in about 2004 is when internet dating really became a big thing. And I met this guy online who lived really far away. So we just decided we were just going to be pen pals. That's all it can ever be because you live too far away. But he was a nice guy. He had a little girl, single dad. He had a respectable job. He lived in a small town community and worked in an area with lots of people. People loved him. I met his sister and his brother-in-law through Skype. I got to know his parents. Over several years, I knew everything about him, I thought. I went to go and visit him. He came to visit me. And in that 7 years, I had been on Alias and Will and Grace. I modeled for Harley Davidson. I got a job working as a mall cop and ended up busting open a major embezzlement ring and took over as director of public safety and security for 6 properties in LA County. I had gone from being a nobody to really establishing myself. Finally got my GED, took a couple college classes in physics of all things. I was really doing well. And this man and I, because we visited each other and we'd spent so much time together over this period of 7 years, he finally asked me to get a fiance visa and move to Scotland to go and be with him. It took him 7 years to get me there. It took him 7 days to start trafficking me. That first week was paradise. I could go anywhere as long as he was with me. I could do anything as long as he was doing it with me. I could visit with anyone as long as it was his family and he was with me. I didn't have my passport. I didn't have my debit card, but I didn't need those things because he was going to pay for anything I needed. He took care of me. It was his job now, he said. Things started going sideways after that first week. And it was just a couple of days into it when I decided I needed to figure out a way of getting my passport and my debit card back away from him so that I could get out. One night while the abuse was happening, he had a couple over and they were whiskey drinkers and so was he. And I had spent some time as a waitress and I understood the value of making sure that somebody never saw the bottom of their coffee cup. And I just did the same thing with his whiskey cup. I got him very, very drunk. I was very, very proud of myself. And I told him while he was fully inebriated that if he were to give me back my debit card and my passport, I could go down to the bank and go pull all my money out because otherwise it's going to sit in the bank and it's going to rot. We'll never use it. But if you give me this stuff back, I can go down to the bank and pull this money out so that we can spend it. And he bought that whole line, gave me back my passport and my debit card. And the next day, rather than going to the bank, I jumped on a computer and bought the first flight out that I could afford. The first day out was $12,000. I couldn't afford that. I had a little over $2,000 in my account. So I couldn't afford the second day either, or the third, or the fourth. But 5 days out, there was a flight I could afford. And it would leave me with a little bit more than $11 in my account. That $11 would be enough to be able to get me on a train and to the airport. So I bought that flight. And I told myself, I've been through worse. I can get through this too. And it was a lie. The abuse got so bad in that 5 days' time that I ended up in a hospital with a kidney infection when that flight left. It was a non-refundable flight. There was an empty seat on that plane with my name on it. And there went my freedom. It left without me. After that, things got really dark. I tried to take my own life. And I remember the day that I got out of the house, I walked down the street to an old church that was built somewhere around the 1600s. And I sat in the graveyard and talked to somebody that was 6 feet under, who was there for so long that their name had worn off of the grave. Stone, headstone. The name hadn't been there for a long time, but it had the year 1776 on it. And I took that as a sign because, of course, that's when we claimed our independence from England. And that's what I was trying to do. I was an American trying to get my independence from the UK, from Scotland. I begged all day long for somebody to just see me. Nobody would see me. Nobody would look at me. If they did happen to see me, you could tell that they were thinking, not my circus, not my monkeys. That's somebody else's problem. I'm not dealing with that. I'm not going to get involved. That's why I get so involved in things now, is because I've been there. And nobody would look at me. So I've got up and I finally sat down on the steps of the church after trying the door. The door was locked. Nobody was inside. And I sat there on the front steps, staring out at the street as people drove and walked by. And nobody stopped. Nobody would look at me. Nobody would interact with me. And at the time, I was a smoker. And I decided I was going to walk down to the train tracks and have my last cigarette. And I sat down on the platform and lit my cigarette. And while I was sitting there smoking it, I was looking out at the tracks and seeing the way, way off in the distance, exactly the point where I would be able to step out in front of the train when it got close enough. So I was going to smoke my cigarette and walk along the tracks until I got to that point and then wait for the train, hide behind a tree. And while I was sitting there, a man walked out onto the platform and he asked me for a light. And I still have that lighter. I have it packed right now, but I still have that lighter. I handed him that lighter and I told him, you can keep it. I don't need it anymore. And I wanted him to ask me why. And he didn't ask. And I knew I couldn't get this total stranger to care about me. He looked at me and he said, I don't need it either. And handed it back to me and I stuck it back in my pocket without thinking much about it. And I looked back at the tracks again. And a little boy walked out onto the platform and walked up to that same man and took his hand. And that little boy looked at me. He looked right through me. He didn't just look at me and look away like everybody else. And whenever we're around kids and we're in a bad mood, the kid kind of absorbs some of that and they start getting that look on their face like they're going to cry or they're going to pout. They want to cry for us and they don't even know why. Kids feel all of this stuff. So we try to cheer ourselves up. We try to smile and laugh or whatever and make light of whatever it is so that these kids aren't upset by how we're feeling. And it didn't work. And this little guy just stared at me. And it was the first time anybody had really looked at me and had seen me as a human being in a long damn time. I keep thinking that it had been since I got to Scotland, but in reality, it had probably been since I was a child. Since somebody had really seen me. And I jumped up and I started running. And I wasn't running toward the train. I was running back towards what I call my prison. And I get teary-eyed every time I talk about this part. I was so happy. Not because I was going back to this place where I had been so abused, but because I knew that if I was going to be kept alive right then, at that moment where I thought my life was over and there was nothing going to be found of me, I knew that my life was going to mean something more. Maybe it already did. And I put together a plan. I started working on it that day, making this guy believe that I would do anything for him and that I was completely devoted to him, loved him dearly and madly. And he bought it. And over a period of months, I would do anything without any kind of complaint with lots of stuff I didn't want to do. Without any complaining, without any expression, I did everything he asked of me. He finally stopped waterboarding me. I was able to actually have food at that point rather than occasionally facing food deprivation. The sleep deprivation mostly stopped. And June rolled around. And I had gone over there in January on the 6-month fiance visa. And the day that we had picked out that we were supposed to get married, that day is come and gone. We're not married. And I told him, you know, my fiance visa is about to run out. And if I overstay my visa, I can get kicked out of the country according to UK law and never be allowed back. And you could lose your job as a police officer. Now, we wouldn't want that, would we? But if you send me back now, then if we wait another 6 months, I could come back. And I could come back in time for Christmas and it would be our first Christmas together. Wouldn't that be amazing? And he bought that. Not only did he buy that line, that story, and that idea, but he bought the tickets. He bought round trip flights that would land me back in Scotland in time for Christmas that year. And instead, I got on that flight, got home, and tried my damnedest to disappear. And he didn't let that happen. He pursued me relentlessly. While I was trying to claim my independence, he was still seeing me as an owned object. He bought and paid for me. I belonged to him. And the day that he was banging on the neighbor's door, asking where I was, I knew I needed to move. He had my address off by one number, and it was on purpose. It was on purpose by me. So I moved again and again and again and again. At this point in my life, I have now moved 43 times. I had moved 43 times before my 43rd birthday. I was so tired of moving. I was so tired of being on the run. In 2016, I finally packed up and moved out here to Colorado. Brought my cats with me because at that point I had built my own family. And I got here and I started kind of trying to rebuild my life or to build some kind of a life. I had already given up so much and lost so much. When I started to kind of rebuild everything, I started getting that footing under me again. I started feeling better about me again. And of course, that's when the bottom drops out. My rock bottom came when I found out that he made me famous on a pornography website. In 2019, a man asked me for my autograph because he'd seen me be raped. I lost my job, I think the following month, because they found out that I was a survivor of human trafficking. And they didn't want that kind of drama in the office. I floundered for a while. I used what I had in a 401k to survive, and I reached out to anti-trafficking organizations. One paired me up with legal teams that would help to fight the pornography websites. And the other one paired me up with a counselor that I traumatized. She left the industry because of me. And I can say that now without placing blame on myself. Yes, she left the industry because of what I told her. But that wasn't my fault. I don't have to own that. They paired me up with a second therapist, and I told her, look, I'm sick of this. I'm tired. So I have a couple of rules. Don't come at me with prescription medication because I'm not looking for a Band-Aid. I'm looking for a shovel. And don't treat me like I am some fragile porcelain doll. If I was going to break, I'd have done it a long time ago. I got work to do. I'm ready to get started. About a year and a half of therapy, including EMDR and immersion therapy, just like crazy therapies that I never thought I would experience in my life. All of them were helpful in their own ways, but there were certain things that helped me more than anything. And the big thing for that was writing. Being able to write and get it out of me. It was like digging to the root of a plant and finding where the poison pieces are and throwing them away. And I never planned for my book to be published, but once it was written, I knew that I had to. So my book was published on my 10-year anniversary of freedom from trafficking. And that was June 19th of 2021. And the very next month is when I met the man that's now my husband. If I hadn't written that book, I wouldn't have met him. I wouldn't have this life that I do now. I'd still be struggling. I could not be happier with my life the way it is now. But it took a whole lot of healing to get here.
Wow. I mean, Amanda, thank you for sharing your story and your vulnerability, and just your strength is just unmatched. I mean, the amount that you have had to overcome. And especially, you know, it's so disappointing and unfortunately not surprising to hear how society, you know, family figures, the world, you know, like what your mom had said about basically being like, you know, you're running away from your problems, and how your employer said, well, we don't want to be associated with this. It's like, how the fuck can, you know, it's just, it's baffling to me that people even function in this way. But you're so right. And this is unfortunately the way it has been and still is in a lot of respects. And I'm so glad that, you know, you have healed so much and overcome so much, and that you're helping so many people. So, you know, a lot of times for people that have been through trauma, they're just desperately clinging to that hope of kind of reaching this normal life, and or reaching, you know, this normal in quotations life. And, you know, it sounds like really reached not just, you know, more if anything, the life that you've maybe never even imagined that you've had in the best way possible. So what would you say to someone who feels like that's so out of reach for them to, you know, show that that's a possibility for them to experience too?
It is never too late. No matter what you've been through, no matter how you have felt your entire life that the chips are stacked against you and this is all you're ever going to be, that's not true. That is not what you were designed for. That's not your reason. That's not your purpose for being alive and being on this planet. I believed that for a very long time of myself. I believed that nobody would want me because I was broken. I thought I wasn't worth loving. I could not get people to care about me. I mean, I can't tell you how often I said that in my life, not just when I was in Scotland. That's not true. The people who don't care about you are the people who just don't know you. And if they truly know you and respect you, they're going to love you and they're going to want the best for you, not the worst. Let go of the people who have hurt you and stop waiting around for an apology that you're never going to get. It is not their place to put you on the path to your healing. It is your place. Trauma changes your brain. You change your life.
Wow. That just gave me goosebumps because I mean, you're so right. And I love that, you know, really anyone can achieve this and just take their power back. And, you know, I'd really love to hear your perspective on forgiveness, because I think that's something that can be so polarizing and challenging in a lot of ways. So what do you think about forgiveness and how do you, you know, take that in now and with your past?
Well, if you and I were standing in an elevator, which we, let's be honest here, we live close enough.
Yeah, we very well could. Yeah.
We were standing in an elevator and you had a large bag in your hand and you turned around suddenly and that bag just slammed me right in the hip. First thing out of your mouth would be, "I'm sorry." First thing out of my mouth would be, "Oh, that's okay." That is a pardon. That is not forgiveness. That is a pardon. You don't tell somebody, "I forgive you for slamming you accidentally with a handbag." You say, "That's okay." That's a pardon. Forgiveness is not the same thing. Forgiveness is saying, "This happened and this is not going to control my life." Forgiveness has to start with forgiving ourselves first. Now, because no matter who we are, we're all going to have some form of personal blame. No matter how many years we work at it, no matter how much it hurts to admit it, we blame ourselves for the things that have happened. And it is not the fault of the abused person ever. We have to forgive ourselves for accepting the blame, for blaming ourselves, and for being possibly in the wrong place at the wrong time, for trusting the wrong person. The abuse is still not our fault. Once we get to the point where we can start to accept and understand and forgive ourselves, now we can get to the point where we say to that person that now is only in our mind, "You're not going to control me anymore. My life means more to me than this. I value myself and I don't want to live in this place of pain. I forgive you. I'll never forget and I will never pardon. But I will forgive because it's time to walk away and let go."
Wow. I love the piece, especially about value. I value myself, because that is such a huge part of it that, you know, we often forget to kind of bring it back to the importance of valuing ourselves and what that means for us and what we're, you know, putting ourselves through at the expense of devaluing ourselves unintentionally in a lot of ways. And I think it's also so important how you said, you know, multiple times, which I think people need to hear constantly to really get that to go through, is that it's not their fault. You know, oftentimes we just internalize things that happen to us thinking we could have done something different, or if we had been this way, this wouldn't have been happened. But you're exactly right. It's not their fault.
I grew up with a mom who told me that if there was something that was repeatedly happening to me, I was the common denominator. I was the problem. I was the person at fault. If teachers didn't like me, if other kids in school didn't like me, if I was being bullied, I was the problem and I needed to change. I look back on that now and realize I was never the problem. I was the symptom.
Wow. No, and you're so right. And that is such an unfortunate sentiment that I feel like a lot of our parents and other generations just take on as the norm. Oh, well, it must be you. It must be you is the problem. And as opposed to, you know, really looking deeper into the situations and what's happening. So, I mean, the fact that you are able to be so wise and so strong and powerful at this point in the best way, it's just so inspiring. So how do you stay positive and celebrate your wins and keep moving forward?
The staying positive part is super easy for me now. When you live through everything that I've lived through, everything is beautiful. I could hear the crackle off of electrical lines outside and think that this is beautiful. And the reason that I bring this up as an example is because I have done exactly that. Everything is gorgeous. You have to pick your battles. You can't let your blood pressure be enraged because somebody cut you off in traffic. Just slow down. And, you know, obviously they need that space more than you do. Whatever. I'm still alive. I'm still here. And you know what? I'm happy. That person that cut you off is probably not happy. That's probably not a very happy person. Enjoy what you've got because you never know when it's going to be gone.
100%.
Yeah. My favorite way to celebrate my wins in life is to create. Yeah, I've written and published 13 books since 2018. I started painting because of my therapy, and I've had international art shows. I've had art sold internationally. I've had a solo art exhibit here in Denver. I've done wonderful things because of my therapy that I didn't even know that I had the ability to paint. But another big part of creating, a lot of us have this need for control as a trauma reaction. You have to learn how to hone that and use it in your benefit, in your favor. I love to cook. Not only do I love to cook because I can control how much of each ingredient goes into something I'm making, but because feeding myself is reminding myself of the love that I have for myself. And feeding somebody like my husband is my way of showing him how much I care and honor and absolutely adore him. Food is my love language. I mean, you can, if I was standing up, and you could probably tell, I love my food. That's probably my favorite way to celebrate. So I'm actually going to be making a steak dinner with prosciutto wrapped asparagus tomorrow for dinner.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. I love that. But I also love how, you know, you've really just completely, you know, widened your lens to just see everything so differently and be able to, you know, not get caught up in all the small stuff and really just focus on the positive and just choose where your energy goes in a way that you have control over and you're not letting people take that from you. I think that's so powerful.
Too many people took too many pieces of me for too many years. I used to call it my slices of my soul. Every single time I'm able to help somebody else or to do something to make somebody else's day a little better, I get a little slice back. I now have more slices of my soul back than I ever lost.
Oh, I love that. I'm totally going to steal that and start using that for myself because I think that's so powerful. But oh my gosh, Amanda, this has just been so amazing and inspiring and just your vulnerability and truth and just your power and wisdom. I love it all. This was so amazing. So where can people find you to, you know, learn more about you, your books, your art, all of your stuff?
Thank you. Probably the easiest way is through my website, growthfromdarkness.com, because that's what we do when we come out of trauma. We grow from the darkness.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Amanda. I've really just genuinely enjoyed this. And I know that this is bringing not just value to me, but just value to so many people. So thank you for sharing your story. And thank you, everybody, for listening to the Healing No Filter podcast. I'll see you next time.